My name is Ben Barrow, and this is Bob Dylan Album by Album, a podcast that brings you an in-depth look at each Bob Dylan studio recording, record by record. So welcome back to our look at Bringing It All Back Home. It's fair to say a good album, isn't it? I probably should have actually not wasted everyone's time by doing five episodes or whatever on this album and just said, it's good. Analysis done. But we shall plough on. And today we're going to have a look at a couple of the love ballads on this album, which I think is quite an underrated part of Bringing It All Back Home. It's an album that is very much, you know, Dylan's first foray into electric music, or not, as the case may be, which we'll get to in this episode. But it also really is kind of him in proper kind of love ballad territory, and I love that. Before we go there, let's say thank you to some people that have bought coffees for the podcast. This is like that internet tipping system I always harp on about. Hi, Kirsty Brown, thank you for your donation. Lars, thank you very much. Hi to, I'm probably butchering this pronunciation, so I can only apologise. I'm going to go with Uwe. That's probably way wide of the mark. As I say, I can only apologise. I mean, I am English. We often pronounce things wrongly because we demand the entire world speaks that language. And also, I'm dyslexic as well, so that's my get out of jail card. Anyway, thank you to you. Hello to Rebecca as well. Sweet Pretty Thing and Alan Zebka, regular contributors on the Buy Me a Coffee page. Thank you. Ian Walsh, thank you so much, mate. Hi to Mark Bunn as well. Hello to Andy, who says, Ben, he's bought me six coffees, right? He says, Ben, five of these are for the normal podcast and one of them is for the Friday episode. Good job on satirizing yourself. What do you mean? How dare you insinuate that? I stand by that song. Friday is one of Dylan's best and I won't hear otherwise. If you want to buy a coffee for the podcast, please do. As always, the link is in the episode's description. So as I said, then this is the next part on Bringing It All Back Home. We're going to have a look at the kind of two love ballads, or the two main love ballads on the first side of this album. I love these songs and I love this record. We also look at the origins of this album as well. So let's go back to 1965 and let's go back to Bringing It All Back Home. Of course, we can't talk about Bringing It All Back Home without talking about Dylan's decision to go electric. And while we're not going to go into that too heavily on these episodes, as it has been talked to death, it obviously plays a role in the origins of this album. While Dylan had gone electric, as in he had recorded with electric instruments before, in fact, before the world even knew his name, it was a gear change to go into this territory for this supposedly folk singer on this album. What's interesting, though, is that outside of this, it really is the first instance of Dylan changing. As we've seen many times on this podcast, his career has been defined by his changes. Dylan loves to reinvent himself. He loves masks. He loves changing and evolving. That interests him. It's why he made albums like Slow Train or Infidels or Time Out of Mind or even Christmas in the Heart. Some of the world are still ignorant to just how much Dylan has changed professionally and personally. They still expect him to be that Greenwich folk singer with an acoustic guitar, but actually most of his career has been anything but that. And this is crucial, he's been successful at that changing too. Successful reinvention is the work of a genius. But pre-Bringing It All Back Home, it's probably fair to say that many people thought that that was it for Bob. He'd be the next Pete Seeger, the mono Simon and Garfunkel, a more commercial Woody Guthrie. But no, he's always had a taste for the spotlight, a performer's quality, an ego, if you will. And his next record would show us just that. Like we saw on the last episode of his podcast, this LP and the context would really be a line in the sand for Dylan, or rather a doorway into a new world. I thought I'd get more power with a small backing group behind me, he's quoted as saying. That was the reasoning behind picking up the electric guitar. But that feels like a schoolboy excuse, hiding a desire to be something else. You see, Bob could have stayed in Greenwich Village and could have been very successful. But with this album, he crosses over. And I don't mean in terms of commercial success. I mean, he opened the floodgates to just who Bob Dylan could be. After this, it's much easier to see into Dylan's future and him becoming a rock and roll star, an icon, a playboy, a song and dance man, and whatever you want, really. And while he had to undergo hardship during this process, like everything of this nature, whether he knew it or not, he was about to make the best move of his career. All this starts in Woodstock. Where else? It's in the summer of 1964 and Bob is staying in his manager Albert Grossman's house. He'd invited Joan Baez to stay with him. Joan had gone from being his mentor to his contemporary to now his lover. This period really seems to be the height of their long-lasting affair. She recalls this time with affection, which is not always the case, in her memoir and A Voice to Sing With. She says, for most of the month, Bob was stood at the typewriter in the corner of the room, drinking red wine and smoking and tapping away relentlessly for hours. And then in the dead of night, he would wake up and grunt and grab a cigarette and stumble over to the typewriter again. He was turning out songs like ticker tape, and I was stealing them as fast as he wrote them. It was clearly a creative time for Bob, and in a letter to her mother, Joan makes it clear that it was a loving time between them too. She says, he bought me a beautiful coat and a dress and some earrings. He's just a joy to be with. We understand each other's need for freedom and there's no chains, just good feelings and giggles and lots of love. And, of course, I enjoy his genius. As we'll see, this is probably the reason that Bring It All Back Home features some tender love ballads, as well as Dylan's quest to go electric. Even before Bob gets to Woodstock, though, he's already got a few songs in development for the LP. Mr. Tambourine Man, a centrepiece for the whole record, was written in February and almost instantly ruled out for potential inclusion on Another Side of Bob Dylan. Another song from that time gets even closer to that album. It's Gates of Eden. This one even appeared on the original manuscripts for Another Side of Bob Dylan, but again it was held back. Or perhaps it was deemed not ready, as it does undergo some changes before making it onto this LP. At least two songs were written that month, If You Gotta Go, Go Now, and It's Alright Ma, I'm Only Bleeding. The latter becomes a hugely important moment on this record, and a song we'll dedicate an entire episode of this podcast to. While the former has a pretty long life for an outtake. While Dylan did demo it here, and a couple of times too, he recorded it a few times with the band and then Angeline Butler from the folk trio The Pilgrims. In May 1965, the album's producer Tom Wilson then edits together parts of several takes and brings in unknown vocalists to overdub additional backing vocals. This version is actually released. It comes out as a single in the Netherlands in 1967, where it fails to chart. But the English band Manfred Mann did have a hit with their version in September 1965. While I don't mind the song, it's definitely a tier lower than most of the offerings on this LP. And unlike some other famous examples, the outtakes on Bring It All Back Home probably, for the most part, do deserve to be outtakes, given the quality that actually does make it onto this record. However, back in Woodstock, you get the impression it's here when Dylan's lyrics take that slight turn to the left. As we saw in the last episode of this podcast, the words on this album are a departure as well as the sonics. By the time he returns to New York City in August, the album's writing is even further down the line. Joan Baez is not present. She's off being a star. She says that Bob saw her off on her tour whilst she got on the train. The quote is, I'm told you went directly from there to a phone booth and called up Sarah. I was ignorant there even was a Sarah. This love triangle, or sort of love triangle, offers as a kind of B-plot to the whole album's recording. For Dylan, though, he was off to do something else that would influence the album, and that was meet the Beatles. Their first meeting is now legendary, but it did have an effect on Bob, as biographer and occasional annoyance Clinton Halen writes, the evening established a personal dimension to the very real rivalry that would endure for the remainder of a monumentous decade. As we've seen, Bob, and particularly John Lennon, were competitive. If Dylan already had one eye on this new sound, this would have sharpened his vision. The Beatles, no strangers to electric instruments and pop music, after all had the one thing that Dylan didn't have, at least compared to them. Huge commercial worldwide success. Now, Bob was successful, but keep in mind there's no such thing as Bob mania, at least not as widespread as it should be, whereas Beatlemania, that was a pandemic. Not long after this, Dylan and producer Tom Wilson were soon experimenting with their own fusion of rock and folk music. The first unsuccessful test involved overdubbing a, quote, Fats Domino early rock and roll thing on one of Dylan's earlier acoustic recordings of House of the Rising Sun. This took place in the Columbia 30th Street studio in December 1964, although Wilson would go on to have success by doing something similar in the form of Simon and Garfunkel's Sounds of Silence and the overdubbing on that track. Bob and Tom would instead take cues from an unlikely source, the singer and musician John P. Hammond, son of John Hammond, the very executive who signed Bob to Columbia Records. Hammond Jr. conceived of an album of electric blues songs. To achieve this sound, he recruited members of a bar band that he'd recently seen. Their names were Robbie Robertson, Levon Helm, and Garth Hudson. Dylan apparently got really excited about their project. A friend of his called Danny Kalb remembers the time saying, "Bob was really excited about what John Hammond was doing with Electric Blues. I talked to him in 1964 and he was telling me all about John and this thing he had going in Chicago." While Dylan would have to wait before he got that very same bar band in, funnily enough, he'd also get John P. Hammond to play for him first, he decided to go back to basics for now. In the first all-acoustic session for this album, they tackle Love Minor Zero, No Limit.
My love, she speaks like silence, without ideals or violence. She doesn't have to say she's faithful, yet she's true like ice, like fire.
While they don't actually get it in this session, they get it in the very next session, and at the very start too. And what we do get is a zen-like love song. For once, Dylan isn't yearning, he's not heartbroken, he's actually celebrating. The opening line is, "My love, she speaks like silence, without ideals or violence." It really sets the tone for the piece. We are immediately presented with Dylan's love, which is widely believed to be Sarah. He supposedly wrote the song while they were both living in the Chelsea Hotel, albeit in separate rooms, officially anyway. The two became a couple in 1964 and they married towards the end of 1965. In these brief opening lines, Bob tells us everything about our heroine, using wonderful juxtapositions. The line where she speaks like silence instantly informs us she isn't like all the rest. She's different. No one speaks like silence. It's impossible, of course. But this type of silence is powerful. It's unshowy. It's unflustered. And it's in control. It's also poetically rewarding, as in it has a wonderful poetry to it. Like the phrase, "the silence was deafening." Our heroine is different. She's superhuman, almost, as is the use of comparing her to both fire and ice. He's comparing his lover to natural forces as strong as both of those. Not only is he saying she is as necessary as them, as in we need fire and ice or water to live, to exist as humans, and so our narrator needs her in the same way, but he's also saying she can be a contrasting person. She is complex and has multitudes. Which will come into play later too. Already in these opening lines, we're hearing about someone Dylan is looking up to, someone better than the world around her. This is well-trodden ground for Bob in his mid-60s run. How many times have we seen him looking for a saviour, looking for someone to shepherd him through this period? That little boy lost on Blonde, or that scene from A Buick Six where he sings, "I'm all cracked up on the highway and in the water's edge. Here she comes down the throughway, ready to sew me up with a thread." And now here, once again, Dylan is looking to a strong woman in his life to help him through. The line of "My love, she laughs like the flowers" is beautiful. It has a wonderful classic literary feel to it. The imagery here is Dylan at his most overly poetic. It's no surprise that the line should echo classic literature because it might have been inspired by it. Ralph Waldo Emerson was a New England preacher, essayist, lecturer, poet, and philosopher. He was one of the most influential writers and thinkers of the 19th century in the United States. And while he isn't often as closely linked with Dylan as some other creatives, like Kerouac, for example, there has been some essays looking at Emerson's influence on Bob, so this is nothing out of the ordinary. In his work Hamatreya, Emerson includes the line, "Earth laughs in flowers." The poem has three sections. In its first section, the poet talks about some men, characters if you will. They are boastful about their wealth and well-being, but they are unaware of their mortality. In the second section of the poem, which is called Earth Song, the poet shares what Earth thinks about these men. Earth is apparently in a sarcastic mood about their foolishness. In the final section, the poet shares his reaction after hearing the story of those men and the song of the earth. So if the Dylan line does come from Emerson, could he be comparing the earth from the poem to his lover, telling us that she is as important as the earth? She's just the same, has the same qualities and attributes. The earth in the poem is laughing at these foolish men, and so is our lover, similarly opposed to her surroundings. The foolishness of man is also found in the third verse of Love Minor Zero, No Limit, as Dylan sings, "In the dime stores and bus stations, people talk of situations, read books, repeat quotations, draw conclusions on the wall." Dime Stores was apparently the original title of this song. In this verse, it feels like Dylan is highlighting a lack of engagement. People talk of situations, read books, and repeat quotations. It seems like Bob is suggesting people regurgitate the same old ideas, or that they can't think for themselves. They're repeating quotes from books rather than having individual thoughts. They draw conclusions not in classrooms or laboratories, but on the wall. It's slapdash, and it's copied, unoriginal, and also on street level. Over the coming lines, we hear our subject rise above this ugly, ill-informed world. Then we come to the line of, in ceremonies of the horseman, even a pawn must hold a grudge. I adore this line, and my reading is that in a game of chess, the horse piece, commonly called the knight, is towards the top of the food chain, whilst the pawn is obviously at the bottom, and is usually expendable. Here Dylan is depicting a scene where, whilst the higher class is celebrated, the lesser beings are loathsome towards it all. It's a corrupt world where the little people are angry towards the establishment. However, the use of the word even suggests that despite being celebrated, the horsemen or the establishment underneath it all are too full of anger, possibly for different reasons. No one is happy here. It's no surprise, though, that our lover is above it all. She, like we've seen before, is better than the other characters here. In the following lines, Dylan sings, "My love winks, she does not bother. She knows too much to argue or to judge." In the final section of the song, it seems to take place on a stormy night, as the world we've seen intensifies. Dylan sings, "The bridge at midnight trembles, the country doctor rambles." Midnight is always a good setting for a story's conclusion. The impending storm is introduced with that line perfectly. Dylan doesn't need to tell us it's stormy or that it's a wild night. He does it in one word, trembles. Sometimes good writing is about being succinct, and here Dylan sets that scene with that indication of weather coloured by the time of the day. But he also introduces that something bad is going to happen as well. The bridge is trembling. If it had fallen, that would be a big event, but here it is trembling, indicating that not only there is a storm to follow, but trembling is something that happens when we're fearful too. He doesn't say the bridge at night sways or buckles. Trembles is in horror story territory. The bridge trembles due to the storm, but also because something bad is about to happen. And this is all done in just 5 words. This storm is confirmed in the following lines of "The wind howls like a hammer, the night blows cold and rainy." Trembles and its connotations also links us perfectly to a forthcoming line, the final line in the song, and its connection to a classic horror tale, which we'll get to in just a second. First though, the country doctor rambles, while not particularly troublesome or alarming to begin with, could be a reference to A Country Doctor, which was a short story written in 1917 by Franz Kafka. In the story, a country doctor makes an emergency visit to a sick patient on a wintry night. The doctor faces absurd and surreal predicaments that finally doom him. While this could easily be reaching here, Dylan has mentioned Kafka in an official capacity before. This was during a press conference in Rome in July 2001. He said, "There's nobody like Kafka who just sits down and writes something without wanting somebody to read it." Perhaps this, and as we'll come to see, other allusions to horror stories, is Dylan indicating the world which he spent the last 2 minutes in is starting to crack up. The next line is perhaps another literary reference as he sings, "Bankers' nieces seek perfection, expecting all the gifts that wise men bring." In Henry James's novel of A Portrait of a Lady, the central character Isabel is affronting her destiny. Her uncle, albeit step-uncle, Daniel's job is as a banker, and upon his death, he leaves Isabel a large sum of money. Whilst this does fit, this feels a little forced for me. Dylan hasn't particularly spoken of his love for this novel. For me, this passage might be a little bit more literal. It once again, though, reinforces a grim world. Taken very literally, we're hearing of the rich bankers who are wealthy from a wealthy family that contains greedy children that are expecting gifts on a par with those that Mary received in the Bible from those 3 famous wise men. Which links us back to the horseman lines from before. Even the rich are bitter. Interestingly, unlike elsewhere, we also have a retort from our protagonist. Dylan doesn't give us a line after this saying, "But my love doesn't need gifts like he does elsewhere." Which plays into the situation our lover finds herself at the end of the song. The final lines here are, "The wind howls like a hammer, the night blows cold and rainy. My love, she's like some raven at my window with a broken wing." All throughout the song, Dylan's rhyming scheme has acted as a call and response. With everything listed from this grim world, there's always been a response from our woman to mirror it. When we heard about people drawing unoriginal conclusions on the wall, our love knows that failure's no success at all. When people carry roses, we know valentines can't buy her. Even the pawn must hold a grudge is paid off by our lover knowing too much to argue or to judge. However, in the final verse, she slipped. Expecting all the gifts that wise men bring is paired with at my window with a broken wing. Perhaps our lover has finally been brought down by this world. She's finally succumbed to it. After all the refusing to judge or seeing the failures of others, here she is, wounded. The use of the raven has obviously linked us with the famous Edgar Allan Poe story, The Raven. The Raven is a narrative poem and a horror story first published in January 1845. The poem is often noted for its musicality, its stylized language, and its supernatural atmosphere. As you know, it tells the story of a talking raven and its mysterious visit to a distraught lover. The main theme of the poem is undying devotion, which feels linked with this Dylan song. They're also both set at midnight, or at least Dylan's final verses. Dylan is a fan of Poe's, we know this. In fact, so much so that in 2012, fans could pre-order tickets for a summer tour via bobdylan.com. To do so, you needed to enter a password. There are a few of them, Lattice and Methought and Morrow and Radiant and quite a few more. Every single word was taken from the raven. Poe stated that the raven itself was a symbol of grief. Specifically, it represented mournful and never-ending remembrance, which again fits our Dylan tune, especially the never-ending remembrance. Our narrator is devoted to his lover, just like in the poem, forever. The title of the song continues this theme. It's a fraction, love minus zero over no limit. Dylan said so himself when he introduced the song live. The name of this song is a fraction, he said. Love minus zero is on the top, and underneath it, no limit. I made the title before I made the song. So if we look at it as a rudimentary fraction, like 1 over 4, for example, one part of a possible 4 or a quarter, so the 4 is the maximum value. This is love minus zero, pure love, real love, love and love alone, and it has the potential to be never ending. It has no limits. Infinity is the maximum value of love. It can go on forever, just like in the poem. While both the Poe poem and the song share themes, they appear to have different endings. Poe leaves it unclear whether the raven actually knows what is happening to our love-stricken narrator, or whether it really intends to cause any reaction, or is simply just existing and our narrator is projecting. Is the raven really haunting the man, or is the man so damaged he is imagining the raven's part? In the Dylan song, though, he sings, "My love, she's like some raven, at my window with a broken wing." So perhaps the raven is less symbolic here and more a wry nod to the Poe poem. Like is the key word for me. Our narrator realizes he too, like his counterpart in the poem, is troubled and thinking about love, but his love knocks for him, not as a possible tormentor, but as a revelation. The broken wing mentioned is a common symbol in poetry and song. It usually portrays a person that has been hurt very badly or very deeply emotionally, but there's also hope with it as well. An angel with one wing intact symbolizes freedom, and no matter what happens, there is still hope. For me, it's the same here. The ending is an ending of realization. While our lover has been superhuman for much of the song, here she is vulnerable, half broken. For me, Dylan is trying to tell us that while he's been eulogizing about her, finally he realizes that she needs him as much as he needs her, or at least the world has brought her down and she needs someone too. She's brushed off the horrors of the world throughout the song, but in the end, she also needs help. The world can bring us all down, even the best of us, but love can outlast and outshine anything. Perhaps Dylan is even saying that the world and life is chained to mortality. Everything must die, everything is fleeting, but love, that can go on forever. Again, just like the raven. Poe also appears in the 2020 Dylan song I Contain Multitudes. He sings, "Got a telltale heart like Mr. Poe, got skeletons in the walls of people you know." He obviously not only names Poe with a reference to his short story, The Telltale Heart, but the second line is a reference to another Poe tale. I Contain Multitudes is a look at Dylan's layered personality and how the world is like that too. It's not black and white, left or right, good or bad. It's full of multitudes. And while Dylan has not just referenced Poe in these two songs and these two songs alone, I can't help but feel like they are linked. In 2020, we muse on how the world may be layered and not black and white. It's not always what you think at the start, just like our narrator comes to see when his love is truly revealed to him in 1965. She is strong and brilliant, but she's also not just those things. She too can be brought down by the world. It's a similar story to a degree for the other love song on This First Sight, She Belongs to Me. On any other record, this would be a jewel in the crown. But here, I feel it's just pipped to the post by Love Minus Zero. They operate in the same world, as Dylan describes a steadfast muse, a woman who is almost otherworldly, glamorous, and has a sparkling ring in this particular song. She once again is commanding, so much so that she can take the dark out of the nighttime and paint the daytime black. She's also fierce and domineering, but she still belongs to our narrator. And while we could sit and debate just who these songs are actually about, could it be the artist Nico or Sarah or Joan or somebody else or pretty much any woman on the eastern seaboard of America between 1964 and 1965, because it seems like Bob did date them all. Either way, it doesn't really matter. These love ballads blossom into wonderful complex sonnets set to music. And while Subterranean Homesick Blues' racket and Mr. Tambourine Man's magical ambiguity take the headlines when this album is discussed, Bringing It All Back Home is much, much richer for having these love songs in its canon.
My love, she speaks like silence, without ideals of violence. She doesn't have to say she's faithful, yet she's true like ice, like fire.
That is it for this episode. I love those two songs we covered in this episode. I know we sort of glossed over She Belongs to Me a little bit, but I think I just end up saying the same things on it, as I said on Love Minus Zero. I think these two songs are really, really great. And I know it sounds stupid to say, but Bringing It All Back Home is one of those albums that's incredible because every song on it is good. Some albums, especially some classic albums, I think, get away with having three or four not so great songs in it because the other songs are so good, but this is not the case with this album. Not only has it got some stunning classics on it, every song is of a kind of really, really good standard, particularly these two songs here, I think. Let me know your thoughts on these two songs and the album as a whole, please. Of course, you can find us on social media at Bob Dylan Podcast. Next time, we are going back to this album and we're having a look at Outlaw Blues and On the Road Again, and also the recording of the record as well, which comes very, very quickly, although it isn't without its difficulty. We'll get to that next time. I'll see you down the road.